Good evening. My name is Lyle, and I am an alcoholic. Nice to be here with you at this celebration. I appreciate the kind words from Robert and his my native brother and Joyce in the back. I ran into her when I came in. She's heard me talk several times before. I've spoken at a couple of her birthdays. So I never really understand why somebody comes back for the second or third version unless they're just checking the facts. I was thinking as I was driving here tonight how different life is for me today, and the fact that not too long ago I would never have wanted to spend a Saturday night with sober, recovering people. What an amazing difference. And I was thinking also that it's probably every bit as miraculous that you're here. Why would we ever do this thing that seems to bring us such great joy and give us a life that that we otherwise wouldn't have had? So I'm incredibly grateful for my sobriety. I treat it much more as a gift than an achievement or an accomplishment, that my sobriety is only the result of people like you and the people who propped me up and held me up, kept me going one more day, one more step until I could begin to kind of sustain on my own here. And I still, of course, am a very active member of AA, and I know that my sobriety, you know, is here. And that if I ever leave it, I'll probably leave my sobriety and this life that I've come to know and enjoy. Customs are different in different places. My sobriety date is March the 7th of 1990. I have 3 days that are very intense, the 7th, 8th, and 9th of March, in which I'm very much able to even at this point in time, look at my watch and know exactly what was taking place on any of those three given days. I remember also getting to treatment, people saying, well, you know, if you haven't had your last drunk, maybe, I mean, if you can't remember your last drunk, maybe you haven't had it yet. And I have often said, I don't know how much of a problem that is for most folks, but I had Dan Rather and Peter Jennings and Tom Brokaw discussing mine, so. As a matter of fact, I had a call not too long ago from Court TV, and I told my wife, the system still works. I didn't know that those two America West pilots were going on trial until I got the call from Court TV, and I told them that the only time I'm willing to do anything like that is if it has a very strong, positive, and productive reason behind it, and I thought they were a little more concerned with the sensationalism and the entertainment part of it, and so consequently I had nothing to offer them and they had nothing to offer me, and we left it at that. But I did tune in a little bit and watch bits and pieces of that trial, and I can tell you every time I did it, my wife is sitting there, it was like I was back there in that courtroom, and I felt like I had red hot stones in my stomach. And I remember the same procedures and a lot of the same questions. A lot of theirs was different, but remembering that and looking at my wife and saying, there but for the grace of God. And I'll bet you there were at least 200 or 300 people that came up to me and said that before the trial, which I'll talk about here in a little bit. But I thought, what an irony. Here I am 15 years later and I'm watching the same thing and I'm saying, man, there but for the grace of God. And I don't think I could do that again. I don't think I could go through that experience again. We're supposed to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I mix the order up a little bit, and I start with what happened. And I've already alluded to some of that, and that was on March the 7th in Fargo, North Dakota. I had my last series of drinks. I find that a little fascinating that I wonder what it would have been like if when I walked into the speakeasy bar that afternoon and evening, if I had actually known that I was not going to drink anymore after that, that those were going to be my last drinks, at least up to this point. I wonder what that would have, I wonder how I would have felt if I could have known that. But that afternoon and evening, it was just another layover as usual. Nothing unusual, nothing extreme, nothing out of the ordinary. I was just going to go out and have a good time like I usually did, and like a lot of us did. And that evening, and the next day and the 2 days following, marked a complete, total explosion in my life, and it changed my life forever. But I also do a couple of things that I talk about what I did for a living. I was an airline pilot. I've had people say, we don't talk about that from the podium, and I think, well, maybe you don't, but I do. It's a part of the story. And I need to explain that, you know, I wasn't an airline pilot who was a drunk. I was a drunk who had a lot of good fortune and was very blessed to have been able to fly airplanes. So it's not a status thing. I don't think we have status in this program. I'm not impressed with somebody who tells me who they are, what they are, what they do, and starts giving me the rundown on all of their stuff. I think the best we ever do here is get sober. And I'll tell you what, I'm plenty happy with that. I'm just real happy with that. That's all I've ever asked for. It's all I've ever wanted. And I've gotten far more than I ever dreamt I would get out of this program. So when I talk about being an airline pilot, it's not a matter of prestige or status. It's just part of what happened in the story. And had I not been an airline pilot, the things that occurred to me could not have occurred because they would not have constituted a federal felony crime. If I had just been an electrical engineer or a plumber or somebody else, none of the stuff that happened to me would have resulted in the consequences and the fallout. The other thing I might as well tell you is it's probably going to take me about an hour five, somewhere around in there, to do this. And so I know that when we get sober, we have this incredible obsession with punctuality. That by God, when that big hand is on that 12, and it starts, when it hits that 12 again, I leave. So if you need to do that, fine, you just go right ahead, and it's not going to bother me. I'd go with you, except I got to finish this. So, and even as much as I try to hustle through this, I can also give you the disclaimer that I'm going to leave about 70% of the story out. You're not going to hear the huge preponderance of the story and the many things that I'd like to talk about that I simply don't have time to trail off into because I had some amazing, incredible, miraculous experiences in other areas that I'd like to share with you, but in the interest of time, I just simply can't. The other thing I do is that in a group like this, I usually have two stories. I tell a Native American version when I'm in a Native American setting, and I leave that out when I'm in a setting like this. So this will be my non-Native American version, because I talk about some different angles when I'm in a Native American event. I drank a lot that night. I had, I don't know how much I had. Don't remember. I don't know about you, but I never went out and kept a score and tally of my drinks. I never said, well, that's number 12, time to go home. I just stayed until the activity was over. But the bar tab showed 14 rum and cokes. Some of them went up as high as, depending on witnesses or who else you listen to, 18, 19 drinks. Had a reporter ask me one time, boy, that was a lot. I said, no, over the course of 8 hours, I was actually a pretty slow pace for me. And it really was, you know, a couple of drinks an hour, that's... I wasn't up to par that night. anyway, there were some things that took place in the bar. I was with two other pilots. That was an unusual thing. I usually was a lone drinker. I did not drink with the crew as a general rule. I was towards the tail end of my drinking career. I was a solitary drinker. I like to drink alone. Frankly, it had come to my attention that most of them drank too slow. And if we went in as a crowd and sat down and I looked around, didn't want to be there, I like to throw the drink down, get out of there and go someplace else. Didn't like to sit around and wait on other people to drink. And as a matter of, you know, I can remember before I knew anything about this disease, being in a group of my friends and feeling sorry for them. I thought, God, these guys are getting old. I mean, are we going to drink? Or are we going to sit around and nurse them? You know, are we just going to pity-pat around, talk? And of course, I would be telling every time the waitress come by, I'd say, well, we'll have another round here. And it wasn't until after I got sober that I became aware of the fact that most of the times when I was drinking with these guys, they'd have two or three drinks stacked up in front of them. But my perception was that they were drinking right with me. That was my perception. And it was completely skewed. But I do remember thinking, man, I hope I never get like that. I just hope I never slow down. These guys are just losing it. And, of course, I didn't know that I was the alcoholic. My tolerance was still skyrocketing. It was just going out of sight. And I had a tolerance. I had a pretty good tolerance. The morning after this drinking episode, very early in the morning, I showed up for a flight with the other two guys and suited up and took a Boeing 727 with 58 passengers from Fargo, North Dakota to Minneapolis, Minnesota. And when we walked off the airplane, I was the first one off. I walked into this crowd of people, and I knew instantly what the deal was. I saw FAA officials, I saw airport police, I saw Northwest Airlines Company officials, and I could leave my airline anonymous. I don't for a reason. I hope by the time I'm done with the story you understand why. Northwest Airlines at that point in time was the only major carrier that did not have a program for alcoholic pilots. Since the mid-1970s, all the other carriers have had those programs. They're superb programs. They're a program that has such a huge success rate, normally around 92-95%, because of the heavy-duty structure. There is a lot of interaction. There's a lot of inter-reporting. There's a lot of accountability. It's not that pilots are better or more gifted than anybody else. It's just that there is a strong monitoring process that goes on for several years, and the success rate is very high. And Northwest was the only carrier that did not have a program for alcoholic pilots. And over the course of my not quite 22 years there, I had watched guys get in trouble with alcohol. I was known to be a pretty careful drinker. And I had watched guys get involved with incidents and alcohol, and the result was always the same at Northwest Airlines. They were instantly terminated. Instantly. And they never came back. It was quick, it was fatal, and it was irreversible. And that was the outcome. And that morning when I walked off into that crowd and I saw these people, I knew that that was what was going to occur with me. I knew what the outcome was going to be. The thing that I will never be able to describe, and yet the big book covers it so beautifully in just a very short phrase, I can't ever describe the instant shame and humiliation that I began to experience. From the moment I walked into this crowd of people, until the end of the experience, and it only got worse and worse and worse to the point where I ended up suicidal. And I truthfully didn't think I had the capacity for that. But the shame was overwhelming. And the big book talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And that just really says it all. Incomprehensible. And I began to experience that immediately. We were, kept for about 12 hours that day. We landed about 7 in the morning. And we were kept until about 7 that night. And in the course of that day, a lot of things happened. We gave blood twice. We were talked to by Airline Pilot Association attorneys. We were talked to by airline company attorneys who finally deposed us towards the end of the day. And I can tell you, every time we had an event, that day seemed like it took forever. The 12 hours felt like 12,000 years. And I would be sitting between events, and I would be looking around, and I'd be thinking, I had these in-and-out-of-body moment experiences. I just thought, this can't be happening to me. You know, there is no way that I could end up sitting here right now in this mess. I mean, my life is over, and I just didn't live it that way. These things occur to other people. I couldn't believe this had actually happened to me. And then I'd have those other moments, those horribly plunging moments when I'd be looking around and think, oh my God, this is real. It's happening to me right now. And I just, it was just an incredibly painful thing. Finally, we were turned loose. We were driven back at 7 o'clock that night. And this was in March in Minnesota. And it was dark. And I remember an assistant chief pilot was driving us back. And I remember looking out the window. It was very quiet. No one was speaking. This was all over with at this point. And I remember looking outside at the blackness of the night thinking, you know, this is exactly the way my life is. From this point on, the light is gone. It will never again be lit. And I'm going to live in the blackness of this devastation for the rest of my life. It's done. It's over. I remember that feeling. I got to a commuter apartment. I could not go to sleep. I walked in. I thought, oh, God, I'd forgotten all about my wife. I was supposed to have been home that night. So I got on the phone. I tried to call her. She was out at the Atlanta airport and had sat out there for 4 hours and was not yet home and wondering what had happened to me. And I get the answering machine, and when it picked up, I didn't know what to say. I was lost for words, and I got some kind of a real soft whispered message out to the effect that there's been a disaster, and I think I've lost my job, and I'll be in on the first flight in the morning. I had what I thought was a completely sleepless night, but I'm sure I dozed at some point. I got up the next morning, put on my uniform, and I walked to the Minneapolis St. Paul terminal, and I was just cloaked and bathed in shame. Every time someone looked my way, I just felt like I was getting hit. I just cringed. I just couldn't take it. They would look my way, and and that wasn't unusual, you know, that they would glance at pilots or people in uniform. But I thought, oh God, they know. They're gonna know. Everybody's gonna know here just very shortly. And I got home to Atlanta. I exited the Northwest area very quickly. I didn't want anybody to see me or speak to me or stop me. And I got to the front of the airport, and I saw my wife sitting out by the curb. And I've never told the story, but what I haven't said, you know, I felt like I walked to the car, and I felt like I had to climb over the curb to get in the car. And I had been married to this lady at that point for 27 years, and I couldn't even look at her. I couldn't turn my head her way. And all I could say is, honey, I'm so sorry. And she pulled away from the curb. And she's from South Texas and has this very soft accent. And she said, who better than I could possibly understand how you feel right now? And we just drove home in silence. I didn't want to talk about anything. And we got home. She went to work. And I went in the house, and it was deathly quiet. And I was just a raw nerve end. And I walked over to the phone, and I called a doctor. He was the only doctor I knew at that time. Happened to be a family therapist. And I called him and said, there's been an emergency, and I need to come in and see you right away. And he told me to come in an hour. And I got in a car and drove over there. I look back at that, as I recall, and think about that moment, that morning and that day. This is now March the 9th. And I thought, you know, I had no business driving that car. I was so devastated. I was absolutely shredded emotionally and mentally. I mean, I don't even know how I got dressed. I really don't even know how I got dressed. So I walked into this doctor's office, and I've said before from the podium, you know, every time I tell a story, I've got the video going up here. I'm seeing it. You can't, but I can. And it's just like I'm right there all over again. And I remember walking into his office, and I told him very quickly, I just told him what happened. I remember him shaking his head, and he said, God, Lyle, he said, this is horrible. This is just horrible. And kind of classic understatement, but he walked around the desk and he made a statement that I didn't understand, and I would hear a couple more of those before the day was over that they just went past me, because as he shook his head and he walked across behind his desk, he said that maybe this is what had to happen, and I didn't understand that. He left a few minutes later, and he came back and he said, I have an appointment set up for you tonight to go see a special doctor at 6 o'clock. He's certified in addiction medicine. I'd never heard of addiction medicine. I didn't know what that was. He said he is a very prominent doctor here in Atlanta. And he said he's a recovering alcoholic and cocaine addict. And he's going to see you at 6 o'clock. Now, this was a Friday, March the 9th, and I immediately was struck by the fact that this doctor is going to see me at 6 o'clock on a Friday. And that told me that somebody thought it was pretty important. Barbara and I drove over there, and he opened up the office area, turned the lights on, She stayed outside. I went inside. I have no memory, no recollection of that meeting with him. I mean, I know I was there, but I can't begin to tell you what he said to me or what I said in response. But I do know, and I don't know if I was there 5 minutes or 15 minutes or 45 minutes. What I do know is that I was so defeated, so shattered, so devastated, so broken, that whatever it was he asked me, I did my utmost best to give him an honest, truthful answer. At least as much as I had the capacity at that point in time to do so. And I didn't try to cut corners, I didn't try to minimize, I didn't try to make excuses, I just told him what he was, I gave him the answer that he was asking. What I do remember is him turning and looking at me, and he said to me, he said, "Lyle, you're an alcoholic and you need to go into treatment tonight." And the other thing that I remember that was significant was that I had no internal reaction to that. And the reason that I think that's significant is because I grew up with alcoholism, and I have hated alcoholics and alcoholism since I knew what it was. My parents were alcoholics, and they took this disease to their grave. I grew up in the Native community, and I saw a lot of drunk Indians at the powwows, and I would always be embarrassed and ashamed. And I would always say, "I'll never be like that. I'll never be like my parents. I'll never be like that." And I've hated that word, because my definition of an alcoholic was life's losers. The people who were the dregs of society, who were the most disgusting, repugnant people I'd ever seen in my life. And he's telling me that I'm an alcoholic. And I have no reaction to that. And as I've thought back on it, I've thought, you know, I think maybe at some level, in the 24 hours since I had been arrested, maybe I had connected the dots. Probably subconsciously. I don't think I was capable of cognitively thinking anything at that point. But I probably had said, you know, your life is destroyed, and it's because you were in a bar drinking alcohol when you weren't supposed to be. And you got caught. And I think that I had come to that realization, even on my own perhaps. I remember telling him, "I thought you would tell me that." And I said, "I don't have a problem going into treatment, but I said, I just got home tonight. And I said, what I would really like to do, please, is to go home and let Barbara just pull the drapes and hang on to me and let me uncoil. Please, just let my mind absorb what's happened. Let me just kind of uncoil, and I'll be glad to go into treatment. I'll do it Sunday or Monday, whatever. I'm okay with that, but I just, please just let her hang on to me for a little bit." He looked at me and said, "You need to go into treatment tonight." And I paused for just a moment, and I thought, you know, why would I come over here and listen to this? Why would I not do what he's telling me to do? So I look at that as my first lesson in willingness, and I paused for just a moment, and I said, okay. So we drove back across Atlanta, following his directions, to a treatment center. And I never thought I'd be in a treatment center. And as we made the final turn to Anchor Hospital at that time, the headlights, it was dark, the headlights hit that sign that is no longer there, but was at the time. It was a big sign, and it said, Anchor Hospital, a hospital for alcoholism and chemical dependencies. And I hit the brakes with the lights on the sign. And I sat, and I looked at it. And it was just like I'd been kicked in the stomach as I looked at that sign with those lights lighting it up. And I thought, 51 years old, and this is where I end up. This is how my life ends, in a treatment center for alcoholics. Can it be any worse than this? And just for a quick moment, my mind kind of flashed through some of the events in my life that I was real proud of. The highlights, the high points, the accomplishments, the achievements, most of them against the odds. And those were the high points of my life, and it was like somebody took an eraser and destroyed them, just wiped them off. They were gone. And I remember sitting there, I felt no value as a human being. I had no self-worth, no value, had no worth. On top of that, it was my 27th wedding anniversary, March the 9th, and I looked at my wife and I said, "Hell of a way to spend an anniversary, huh?" And she said, "Might be the best one we ever had." And I got to tell you, I couldn't even begin to address or process that comment. How could anyone think that at that moment in time? And we put the car in gear and we went down the hill and I went into this treatment center. And I remember wondering what this is going to be like, going down the hill to this treatment center. And the only thing that came to mind was that movie, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It was anything but that. It was anything but that. It's a wonderful place. And I have problems with speakers that come up and bash treatment centers. And sometimes I react to that. I try not to get into a lot of opinions and a lot of podium stuff, but I thank God for that treatment center. Thank God for it. What I think I'll do is stop here and go back and kind of flesh in the rest of the story and try to get through here in a decent period of time. And I'll start it and tell you I was born in Wichita, Kansas, September of 1938, so I'll save you the math, which I always do. I'm 66. Sometimes just for the heck of it to see whose mind is clicking, I'll say, so I'm 74 years old. And I'll see people out there going, oh, wow. Now, I always do the math. I was born into a very blue-collar family. Two very good people were my parents. And I owe them a lot, and I think it's always important that I acknowledge that from the podium. That my parents were not drunk all the time. There was no drinking in my family for a good period of time in my memory. I don't know that that's accurate. Then all of a sudden, that's all I remember, is the alcohol and the drunkenness and the chaos that took place at that point in time. We didn't have a whole lot. We lived in an area off the edge of Wichita called Plainview. It's where the economically disadvantaged sort of lived, but I was a very happy kid. I remember being very happy. I had a sister, and I remember growing up and being happy with that. My parents divorced when I was 14, and that took a heavy toll on me. That really hit me hard, really affected me, big time. And within a few years, and I don't know the exact time frame, each of them had been married and divorced two more times. I was going through high school at this point in time, and I didn't get along too well with step-parents or step-siblings. And so I would get into some kind of a conflict, and then I would end up going to the other family until something erupted over there. And then I would go back to this other one, and as they were doing their thing, sometimes the program changed, and there were all new cast of characters over here. I don't remember any of my stepbrothers or stepsisters. I wouldn't know if they walked in the room tonight. I don't know if they're where they are, if they're dead or alive or anything. I was a pretty good student when I applied myself, but nobody cared, nobody watched, and I was a kid and I took advantage of it. I squandered a lot of academic opportunity in school. I was an athlete, probably average at best. And I graduated when I was 17 years old from this high school in Plainview. This was in 1956. I wasn't drinking a whole lot at that point in time. I looked too young. You only had to be 18 to drink. But I could never, my buddies would put me in the middle of the group and we'd go swaggering through the doors like we owned the place and they always plucked me out and we'd turn around and go back. So I wasn't too successful at drinking early on. But I had decided I was going to join the service and didn't know what I was going to join. There was an Air Force base there in Wichita, a lot of aircraft manufacturing companies there. It's called the air capital of the world. Most of my buddies married their high school sweethearts at age 18 and went off to work at Boeing, Beech, Cessna, Swallow, Lear, whatever it was that was there at the time. But I decided to join the service. About that time, one of my buddies came back from the Marine Corps and was fresh out of boot camp and looking really sharp and in that uniform, and we went to a bar and we sat there for hours on end, and he regaled me with all these stories, and I was fascinated by these horror stories of what Marine drill instructors do to the recruits in boot camp, and I suspect there was maybe a small window of opportunity to alter the rest of my life if I had sought professional help, because I just couldn't wait to go down and sign up. And so I did. Within a day or two, I found me a Marine recruiter, and off I go for this masochistic, wonderful experience of a lifetime. Now, I hear a lot of people who share stories from the podium say, you know, I never fit in, I never belonged. And I know that's true for them. That's their story. That is not my story. I got to boot camp. I had never been a standout at anything. When I wanted to do the 13 weeks of boot camp, I just wanted to survive it. I just wanted to get through and hopefully not be noticed. I was even after anonymity even at that point, but I didn't get it. So when we graduated 13 weeks later, I had really excelled. I had found a place that I really fit in, that I loved. It was tough. It was structured. It was disciplined. The camaraderie was beyond words. We were close. We were tight. We were just, I mean, I loved it. This is where I really wanted to be. And they awarded several pairs of PFC stripes, and to my complete total surprise, I was one of the guys, two or three guys, that got a set of those stripes. And was extraordinarily proud of that. I mean, I had never had a high moment like that in my life. Went to Camp Pendleton. I remember sitting in a hut one time. It was raining. All my buddies were just slick sleeve privates. I had this heavy duty rank on my sleeve, one stripe. But I was enjoying the privileges. I was inside as a corporal of the guard, and my buddies were outside walking post in the rain. And I remember looking over at the corner, and there was an officer's uniform over there. And I thought, you know, I just turned 18 not long ago, and I may have a real career here, because at the rate I'm moving up, general can't be too far away. And I loved it. I came in 4.5 years later. Commanding officer said, there's a new program out called Marine Aviation Cadet. He said, you're the only guy in the unit that's got the scores to go into that and the qualifications. And I thought about that, and I had always wanted to fly. But flying, people who come from my background are not the kind of folks who get those opportunities, I didn't think. Those were reserved for the more well-to-do, the people who were well-educated, college folks. And I was none of that. And they were telling me that there's going to be somewhere like 50% are going to wash out, plus or minus. And I knew that everybody coming in from the street side, which was going to be probably 90-95% of the people, had to have 2 years college minimum, and I had none. And so I could do the math. I could figure if more than half or roughly half are going to wash out, I'm in the high probability of the group that's not going to make it. And I don't fail well. I just don't like to fail. I don't like to fail. I had decided, I had tested for this program, and they said, your scores are great, you should be able to complete. But I still was scared. I had decided to go for this. I went home to Wichita for a powwow and told my friends that I was going to Pensacola. And so during the powwow, they had what they call a special for me, and I went out and danced, and my friends joined me. And all the way down to Pensacola, I remember being impacted. That's not a big deal, really. But it was for me, because I remember thinking, you know, I'm the only person in this community who has a chance to do what they're offering me to do. That if I'm successful, after 18 months, I'm going to get a pair of gold wings. Man, I couldn't believe a pair of gold wings to wear over my chest, my heart here. And I'm going to get a set of gold bars. I'm going to be a commissioned Marine Corps officer. And that was almost too much for me to even imagine or dream. And none of my Indian people are going to have that chance. And I could not go back to that community as a failure. I could not show up 6 months, a year later, and tell them I'm back because I didn't make it. And I was driven through that 18-month process. There are four phases to that. But I was driven through that process by nothing but fear. Now, we would drink on the weekends. I wasn't drinking real hard and heavy now. My drinking was not one of these instant alcoholic drunks. I had to kind of work into it. But I've got a good work ethic. I was working scared. And through every one of these four phases, I always graduated as the number two guy. And I was always surprised. And the first time or two, I was convinced. I knew somebody had jumbled numbers or names. And that there was an administrative error, huge administrative error, that I didn't belong there at that top of the list. And I never managed to build any level of confidence and believe that I was really doing as well as the numbers and the grades and the papers were reflecting. I just really didn't. And I knew I was going to wash out. At some point in time, I knew. I was watching my buddies pack their sea bags with tears in their eyes, sometimes crying, because their dreams were over and they were leaving us. And I thought, someday they'll get me. Someday that'll happen. My last 6 months of flight training, I left Florida area and went to Texas. immediately, it was a Friday night when I got in there. It was before Vietnam, so weekends were open for us. And we hit the officers club, and I reunited with a bunch of my buddies, and we got splashed and really nailed. And I was in advanced jet flight training, the final phase of training. I'm back with my buddies. We're all reunited. They said, let's go into this little town, Beeville, Texas. They said, there's a drive-in, old-fashioned drive-in in here, and that's where the South Texas girls hang out. And there's some good-looking girls in there, and they think us cadets are pretty hot stuff because we have a lot of that marrying potential. And so I said, fine. We drove into the drive-in. They immediately went after a carload of girls, and I've never been that gutsy, and I thought, well, maybe I need a few more beers. So I was drinking, and I thought, I'm ready to go. And I noticed the driver of the car wasn't talking to anybody. So I thought, well, that's where I'll go. And I had rehearsed two or three things that I thought were really hip, slick, and cool. But you know how we are when we're drunk, you know. We think it's hip, slick, and cool. Nobody else does. And I walked up to the car and was really drunk. And I think I said, hello, or something. And she turned and looked at me. And it was a good-looking girl. God, she was good-looking. And everything that I had rehearsed just kind of left me. And I got something out like, you have the prettiest brown eyes I've ever seen. Something like that. And she's looking at me, you know. And I feel like I'm stuck in molasses. I wish I had never gone up there. And I don't know how to get back. And I'm looking at her and I think, God, I feel like such an ass. And I look at her face. I'm going, she thinks so too. And I just turned around and I left. I walked away. Didn't say another word to her. And the next day I was in town doing some administrative stuff, setting up checking account because I was going to be there for 6 months. And I was headed back to base and I saw her going to the same restaurant. They had an indoor and I almost wrecked the car, skidding through this gravel parking lot into that. Had a cadet buddy with me. I walked in and feigned surprise. And I was sober and asked her if we could buy him a Coke or a cup of coffee and began to talk with her. And she said I could call her. And that was the girl on March the 9th as I walked into the treatment center that had stayed with me for 27 years. On February the 25th of 63, her 20th birthday, she pinned my gold bars and gold wings on me. And what a day that was. A day that was just so hazy with delight and euphoria. I had made it. And she and I launched off to California. All my dreams had come true. I had the prettiest little wife. I had my wings, my bars. I was flying jets. I was with this tremendous bunch of guys. Life couldn't have been any better. I immediately let her know that by God, every Friday night when the squadron had happy hour, I would be there. And I was. And the first two happy hours in a row, I wrecked the car. And I thought, this doesn't bode well for this career, and I'm going to end up with a bitching wife here if I don't. So I lied to her. Somebody hit me in the parking lot. They wiped out the whole side of the car, and my buddies would come out and look at it. And she'd go, can you believe somebody hit Lyle in the parking lot, and they just double over, you know, and I'm trying to wink. And so I wasn't starting off real red hot. But we really had the perfect life. Now I'm really drinking at this point, but we all were. This was part of what we were supposed to do. We were hotshot young pilots. We were supposed to fly hard, play hard. This was part of the persona that we were supposed to flesh out and do. And I was a good drinker. Nobody had to encourage me or teach me anything about that. I was someplace one time and some guy said, well, I learned to drink in the Air Force. I said, well, I was a Marine. They didn't have to teach us. And anyway, we had this great career going for us. I headed for Vietnam. She and I immediately had two little babies, 8 days less than a year apart. And I'm here to tell you that you do not have to be a Catholic to do that. And everybody, are you guys Catholic? You know, I go, no, just a couple of horny Protestants and birth control. Birth control not being what it was then, you know, it was just real easy to do. And so I launched for Vietnam. And I went over there. We were one of the first jet squadrons in there flying out of a very primitive combat expeditionary airfield. The flying was very tough, very challenging. And I was with 20 or so of the finest pilots I've ever been privileged and honored to be with. We did a lot of flying over there. While I was over there, I got a regular commission, something I never thought they'd ever give a high school graduate. I had had a really good career up to that point. I came back and finally decided to resign because of the family separation that was going to take place before I could give up this career. And I'll tell you, it was a painful, anguished decision to sit down and give that career up. But it was either my family, and I had always said, I told Barbara, I said, I want you to be a stay-at-home mom always. I don't care what our finances are. be here for these kids. And so she did, and she was. And I'd promised her that this family will not be like the one I grew up in. This family is going to be safe and solid and stable and secure. You know, there's going to be a lot of love in here, and there are going to be two parents fully involved in these kids' lives. And that was my promise, and I gave up that career because of that. And it was a tough decision. 2 weeks after I had done that, and I had gone in as a barely 18-year-old kid in 1956. I had gotten out 11 and a half years later, and I was a seasoned jet pilot, combat veteran with some nice decorations, and a very senior captain. So I had had a good journey. I had done well in the Marine Corps. Went to Northwest Airlines, and for almost 22 years, we had about the same kind of career there. There were times when I couldn't drink a lot because of the financial situation, the starting over again at the bottom. We just didn't have the money for it. But again, I'm in that same set of drinking environment. I don't do a big drunk log because I don't have time for it. I did everything you did. I had two DUIs about 5 or 6 years apart. Just bad luck. You know, that could happen to anybody. And what anything I did, just bad luck. I had fights in bars. I had blackouts, a lot of blackouts. I lost cars. I had a lot of things happen that we all have happen. Unlike most of you with the DUIs, I go, anybody can get a DUI, I think maybe I'll go big and get an FUI. And it's flying under the influence for those of you whose minds might be going someplace. After we got to the airlines, we adopted a little girl. Had always talked about adopting a little girl. And this little girl was supposed to be the daughter my wife always wanted. We worked real hard because we had these two biological kids, and we fought hard. And it took us 14 months, and we got this beautiful little Chippewa girl who came to live in our house when she was 17 days old. She was every father's dream. She was the most beautiful little thing. God, she just melted my heart and stole it. And, of course, I didn't know when we got her what little girls do to their dads. And she grew up in my house, and she was really my sunrise and my sunset. She was the center of my universe. And she could never walk past me without me saying, Dawn, come over here and give me a hug. And I'd look into that pretty little face, and I'd say, thanks for being my girl. She'd say, thanks for being my dad. And she was my sweetheart. And I thought we had a great family, and when she was 17, she ran away from home. I didn't see it coming, neither did my wife. I don't know if I had not been drinking, if something would have tipped us off to that. I don't know, and I've quit wrestling with that. I had a hard time believing that I would ever be an alcoholic. I didn't get drunk every night. Rarely ever drank in the mornings. I didn't drink every weekend. But once I start drinking, I don't quit. That's the thing. I don't quit. I have every reason to quit. I have every intention of quitting, but I don't quit. There are other things that I learned in treatment that pegged me very clearly, evidentiary-wise, as being an alcoholic. I knew a lot about living with alcoholics and seeing them, but I didn't know anything about the disease of alcoholism. And I had made tests along the way. And I passed them all, of course, because I designed them. And there were times when I quit drinking for, you know, a month or 2 months. I go, no alcoholic can do that. Who told me that? Nobody. I invented it. But it made sense to me. And so I conclusively knew that I was not an alcoholic until I got to treatment. So this little girl ran away. I had put off being a captain until she graduated from high school. And I finally went to Chicago to take a special written test. And I called home the next day, and Barbara told me she had run away. That afternoon that Barbara had taken me to the airport, Dawn and some of her friends had gone to our home and taken what she wanted and left a note. And Barbara found it later that night. and couldn't call me, wouldn't call me because she was afraid I wouldn't do well on this test if I knew what had gone on. The next day when I was getting ready to go home, called her from Chicago. All she said was hello, and I knew something had happened. I knew. That's all she said was hello. And I forced her to tell me Dawn had run away. And I blurted out these panicked instructions about where to go, who to call, where to look. And I got on the airplane, and about 2 hours later, I was back in Atlanta. And by the time I landed, everything had changed. The whole world had turned upside down. And I walked out to the car, and I told Barbara, forget trying to locate Dawn. I said, she will never again, ever be allowed in my home. Ever. In that 2 hours, I don't know what happened or how it happened. But I had come to such an incredibly white-hot, raging hatred of her that I didn't want to see her or have a thing to do with her for the rest of my life. And I so informed the rest of the family when we got home. Excuse me. And I made it very clear that I was never to hear her name as long as I was alive. And inside of 2 days, I had moved everything. All of her furniture was gone. Anything in that house that she had ever touched or imprinted in any way was gone. The best detective in Atlanta couldn't have found a trace of evidence that she'd ever been in my home. I went to the bank and I ripped up the adoption papers. I immediately took $500 to an attorney and disowned her. Then I tried to annul the adoption and I could not. And I stayed in this state of rage for over 2 years. Now, I looked around at the family in the immediate aftermath of this, and I made a very benevolent assessment. I said, you know, I think my wife is having some problems dealing with this, and she needs a therapist. And that's why I called this doctor. Plucked his name out of the phone book, and the luck of the draw, I got a good one. Got a really good therapist. And we saw him just about weekly for almost 2 years. He knew more about me than anybody except my wife. And I didn't really like talking about my daughter very much, but I do remember one of the things that really stands out was one time something came up about her, and I made a statement that to the best of my knowledge I had never thought or formed the thought or said before. And it's one of those movie moments because he's standing, leaning up against the desk and looking at me, and he said something to me, and I said, let me tell you something, doctor. I said, I would rather hate than hurt. And he looked at me, and he said, Lyle, he said, that worked for you as a child. You survived a childhood doing that. And he said, if you continue that, it'll destroy you. And I did not respond to him, but I'll bet he could read my mind. Because I looked at him, and I thought, well, you may be a PhD family therapist, but by God, I'm an airline pilot. And I'll do it my way. And he was absolutely right. Nothing he told us over the course of those 2 years was ever incorrect or untrue. And so this is kind of where we were when this had all happened. And I would drink sometimes. Father Martin talks about feelings, neither being good nor bad, but being positive and negative. And talks about the only bad feelings are the ones that we cultivate. And I can tell you, I cultivated mine. I would sit in a room by myself with a fifth of booze or a quart, and I would drink this, and I would just sit there and obsess about this girl and about all of the things I'd done, the martyrdom and the self-pity, which, of course, fueled the anger, and I would just end up absolutely white hot all over again. I kept this thing going. And that's kind of where we were when this incident took place. And he's the doctor that I called that morning to go in and talk with. I went through the treatment process, and I had a very intense 28-day deal there. I went in, and nobody for the first week knew the color of my eyes. I could not and would not look up to I would not meet your gaze. I sat in the groups with my head down. I walked with my head down. No one, I could not pick my head up. And I didn't want anybody to know who it was. And then within 2 or 3 days, the media had it, and now I'm all over. The hospital had 2 TV sets. I'm the lead story, every news segment, and now everybody knows. And I became suicidal in there. The only time I thought about suicide was in Vietnam. And I wrestled back and forth with, would I allow myself to be captured if I was shot down? And I never reached a firm decision on that. And suddenly in there, I learned that I was not nearly as tough as I thought I was and as other people thought I was, because I hurt so much and it went so far beyond any threshold I had ever even heard of or remotely imagined that I wanted it to stop at any cost. And I was beyond the romancing, flirting idea with suicide, and I was going to execute this idea. And I had what could only be considered, I guess, a God-given moment of clarity. And I thought, the thought hit me, you know, if you do this, it'll be the only thing that's worse than what's already happened. Your family will never survive the scarring and the stigma of a suicide in this treatment center. So I began somehow to think more about living than dying, although I did exert incredible foot-pounds of energy trying to just will myself to die. If I could have just fallen over and been dead without hanging myself or cutting a wrist, I would have taken that in a heartbeat. I would have accepted that, no questions asked. And I went through this treatment center, this treatment process, and at the end of 28 days, I was working harder in there than I ever did to get my wings. The good thing about being taken to the edge of suicide, and it took me years to see this, I've looked at that as probably the greatest single act of love that God could have bestowed upon me. In spite of the pain, in spite of the anguish and the sheer horror of everything that I was experiencing, it was the best act of love He could have given me. Because when He took away all my hope, all of my resistance, I had nothing left going for me in there. So I didn't debate. When the counselor said something, I didn't necessarily understand it, but I tried to do it. And so I figured this was the last house on the block for me. I don't know about their answers. I know mine aren't good because I've ruined a life using mine in spite of how good I thought it had been at some point in time. So I devoutly tried to do what they told me to do in that treatment center, whether I understood it or didn't. And there were many things I didn't understand. Simple things. Real simple things. Because I've got to whirl them up, complicate them, and try to get them all interwoven and try to figure this stuff all out. And finally I just quit doing that. I came out of the treatment center and, well, let me back up. I'm missing a real important part here. In the first week I was in treatment, I walked into a group therapy, session. They closed the door. And I had not talked about my daughter. Excuse me. And I didn't intend to talk that day, didn't intend not to talk. But for some reason, I began to talk about my daughter, and I broke down and cried. Now, I had not cried at either one of my parents' funerals. I didn't think it was okay to cry. That was something I just didn't do. And I broke down, and I sobbed about my daughter. And it was just like my heart had been ripped out of my chest. But, you know, that particular moment, it was like something lanced all that poison inside of me. And the group came around me, and they hugged me. And, of course, I felt naked. I felt ashamed. You know, I felt, oh, God, But it was one of the breakthrough moments that I had there. And shortly thereafter, I told Barbara, I said, write to her and tell her let's put the family back together again. I want to see her. Now, we had no visitors and no phone privileges, but the treatment staff said, that is such an impossible thing for you to do. We will give you a day room if she wants to come up. And she came up from Florida. And the two doctors, the family therapist and the doctor who diagnosed me, got wind of this, and they said, could we please come watch? The family therapist said, I had written this family off. I'd said, there's no way this will ever occur. And they said, if we stay out of the way, can we please come watch? And they were off to the side. The morning I walked in, and I saw my daughter for the first time in 2 years. And I had forgotten how little she was. I didn't remember that. And in her arms was a 5-month-old girl, a granddaughter. She had gotten married. I didn't know her last name. And I walked over and I hugged her. And I can't tell you what it felt like to tell her how much I loved her instead of how much I hated her. And I picked that little 5-month-old granddaughter up. And God, she stole my heart as fast as my daughter had. And my wife was watching this. All of this. As were these two doctors. And I told my kids, bad things are going to happen. You're probably going to see me tried, handcuffed, and taken to prison on TV. And you need to gear up for that. I got out of treatment. In that same period of time, all of a sudden, here came legal crises. Now, I'd been fired a week to the day that I entered treatment. That was on TV. Thank you. I'd been fired. The FAA had taken all my licenses, and I had lost my FAA medical certificate because of my alcoholism. I was completely naked and stripped of everything. Within 30 days, I was broke. I had grown up poor, and now I had lost everything, and I'm back to where I started, all over again. I'm broke, and I'm stripped of everything. And I'm a firm believer in acceptance of responsibility. And everything that happened to me was fair. It was fair. I didn't deserve the medical certificate, and I didn't deserve to hold those licenses. And Northwest Airlines was 100% justified in firing me. Now, all of a sudden, I'm hearing about criminal proceedings. No one, including any of the lawyers, either at the Airline Pilots Association or at Northwest Airlines, knew anything about a law that was on the books, a federal law, making this a felony crime. And suddenly I'm hearing, I start getting word about Minnesota's going to indict me, North Dakota's going to indict me. There were six crises that are going 2 and 3 and 4 days apart. They're coming and taking me out of the groups to tell me this, and I'm flinching. Every time they come into a group, I just hold my breath. And they look around and they go like this to me, and I don't want to go. I don't want to go outside. And every time they give me the news, it's worse. And it's like they just suck the air out of the room and I can't breathe. And finally, they came and they took me out the last time, and the doctor was there, and I thought, oh God. And they took me down to his office and made me sit down, and they said, Lyle, I have to tell you, a federal grand jury has just come in, and you've been indicted under a federal statute, and you're looking at 15 years in federal prison, a $250,000 fine, and an attorney's coming in Sunday and wants $50,000, which I didn't even remotely have. And he looked at me and said, I have to ask you if you're going to do anything to hurt yourself. And I said, no, sir, I won't. But I went numb. It was like all my nerves shut down. I couldn't feel anything. And I went back to my room, and I paced. And I thought, God, what am I going to do? And I don't remember collapsing. What I do remember next is lying on the floor with my head against the carpet, and I was crying again. And I was exhausted. And I said, God, I can't do this anymore. I just can't do this anymore. Please help me. And I remember sleeping that night, which I find amazing. I had just received the most horrific news of all, and I slept that night. I got out of treatment, and I went up to Minnesota. I was quickly in a trial. Now, these two America West guys that you saw, their incident took place almost 3 years ago. By that time, I had had my trial, been in prison, and was halfway through my probation. I was in trial within months. About 3 months of my incident, I was in federal trial, in federal court. And as was normally the case, I never got a break. I drew the toughest judge up there. And he had some feelings about this situation, as well he should have had. We went through a 3-week trial up there. I had an advantage over the other two guys because I was the alcoholic. I had rooms to go to. I had meetings to go to. I could go and sit, and I never shared. And I was really nervous at first because people would recognize me from the TV. And I would never share, but I would just go sit and I would take the energy that you would give me and I would get through the next day in court. It's a horrendous, unbelievable experience. I went through there and we were quickly found guilty. Had an experience with an attorney that I would dearly love to share with you, and I can't in the interest of time. Incredible man. Did amazing things for me. It was part of the miracles of the story. We were quickly found guilty, as I knew we would be, and we went back some months later for the sentencing. A federal judge I'd been with in treatment says the sentencing thing is a charade. You're going to talk, your lawyer's going to talk, you may or may not have witnesses, but the sentence is set. And you need to know that. He said, we do not change from the bench. When we come in the courtroom, the sentence is set. We've already researched it, we've had the letters, we've heard all the comments, we've heard all the, nothing changes. And then a day and a half before sentencing, he leaked it to the press and notified all three attorneys that he was going to escalate the sentencing. Federal guidelines were in place at that time, 12 months minimum, 18 months maximum. I'd been the captain. I knew I was going away for 18 months. I'd made some degree of peace with that. I worked a lot on acceptance. Now, all of a sudden, he said he's going to up the ante. And the prosecutor hadn't even asked for it. So here comes the experience of terror all over again, the one that I was so familiar with. And we walked into sentencing that morning, and he lectured for 30 minutes about what was getting ready to happen and why. And I was the first to stand and speak, and I was so scared that I had not been able to compose anything. And my prayer was, just please let me talk from the heart. Because I got to stand up in front of a hostile judge, a hostile jury, media behind me doing all this stuff. And I talked about being grateful for being sober. I talked about being grateful for the things that had happened in my family. I talked about accepting responsibility and the fact that I couldn't change what happened the day before, much less what happened months before. To everybody's shock, he announced a sentence on me of 16 months, 2 months less under the guidelines. 3 or 4 years later, he told my attorney that morning he fully intended to sentence me to 4 years in federal prison. And he changed it from the bench. The thing I've heard they never do. Now, I wasn't real anxious to go dancing off into prison for 16 months, but it was a lot better than what I was looking at, what I was thinking. I was thinking I was going to get at least 5 years. He also did something that surprised everybody, because I expected to be let off into custody, and I had given my wife my personal effects before I walked through the defendant's swinging doors there. He said, this is a complex case, first of its time. Nobody's ever been tried under this law before. I know there are going to be appeals. I'll let you three gentlemen, remain free until your appeals are exhausted. The other two said, fine. I said, no, sir, I won't. I'll go to prison now. Because I'd learned in here to live life on life's terms. I did not want to walk into the penitentiary. I was scared. And I told my kids, I said, the reality is I can't come out the back door until I go in the front. And the sooner the better. The judge says to this day that he has never had a defendant before or since ever do that. It stopped him in his tracks. He didn't know quite what to say. I said, I want to go into prison right now. And I did. Within just a very short period of time, I was in the Atlanta Federal Prison. I served 424 days, one day at a time, shorter when necessary. I had a guy, interestingly, and we have some humorous moments, a guy came up to me after I'd spoken, he said, 14 months. I had 14 months, 54 days good conduct time. He said, 14 months, man, I was in there 18 years. I said, good for you, you win. I never talk about the prison experience from the podium because I don't think it has anything to do with my recovery, but my recovery has everything to do with my prison experience. I got out of there. I was broke, stripped of everything, the most notorious pariah in aviation. I began to think sometime later about possibly flying again. The FAA said, if you want to fly again, you start all over again with a private license. I'd never had one. I came out of the Marine Corps and was given a commercial with an instrument ticket. And not one of my friends that I talked with or chatted with, not one thought it was possible to go back and start at the bottom, literally from the ground up, and get licenses back. But in here, and I wouldn't have tried it, because if I looked at all the licenses and all the requirements and all the work involved, it was too much, too overwhelming, and I would never have attempted it. But in here, I have learned to do things one day at a time, one thing at a time, one step at a time. And when I do that, I can do just about anything. So I used that approach on the licenses, and I told my wife, I said, I've got to change my attitude. If I think this is overwhelming and impossible, it is. If I think it's something that I'm going to enjoy doing, I'm going to go back and review things that I learned in 1961, and I'm going to make this a pleasant experience. That's what it will be. And so I did that, and 10 and a half months later, I had all four licenses back. No shortcuts, no quick fixes, no cut acrosses. Everything was done the hard way. But there's a flying part that goes with that, and I looked at that and I said, $10,000, $20,000, we're broke. No way. That's the stopper right there. The judge had put sanctions on me that made it impossible I'd ever fly again. That's one of the miracles that I don't have time to go into, but he had lifted that. No one thought he would do that. But it just took one of the S's out of the word impossible, because everything else was still in place. About that time, I get a letter and a phone call the same day from a pilot at Northwest, and he said, I have a flight school. I want you to come up to Minnesota and live with me and go through my flight school free. I was under 13 conditions of probation, so I had to coordinate with the Georgia Department of Corrections, go up, check in with the Minnesota Department of Corrections, and for 44 days in the summer of 93, we got massive rains all across the country, and the country flooded. But during that period of time, I spent living with that man and his family, flying little airplanes that I had never flown before, and I got all my licenses back. I got two of them in one day, and I don't know that that had ever been done before. I came back to Atlanta, and I thought, that's great, but who's going to hire me? Everybody knows my name. Everybody knows about the Northwest Flight 650 incident. I thought, you know, that my only chance of flying again is if I can find a place in Africa that has no TV. Maybe I can fly airplanes that are wired and chewing gum fastened together and sheep and goats and get $5 an hour. On the very night that my licenses actually arrived in the mail, which was several months later, I received a phone call from the head of the pilot union at Northwest. I had never resisted my firing. I had never fought it. A grievance had been automatically filed, but I had never activated it because they didn't fire me for being an alcoholic. They fired me for what I had done, and they were justified. It was fair. This man told me, he said, "This is the best phone call I have ever made," because he said, "John Dasburg, the president and CEO of Northwest Airlines, tonight, 3 hours ago, personally reinstated you to full flight status at Northwest Airlines. It was an act that defies all manner of description of courage. It is so far beyond the word extraordinary, I can't picture it. Why would he take a chance on me? He risked his entire career by bringing back a convicted felon, confirmed alcoholic, to put me in the cockpit again. What happened if I drank again? What happened if I had another flying incident? He would forever be blackballed because his judgment was fatally flawed. And he took that kind of a risk on me. And to this day, I don't know why. But I went back and signed a back-to-work agreement November the 1st of 1993. Never, if I ever drank again, I was forever done. That was fine. I was never to be a captain again. I said, I don't care about that either. That's fine. I've been a captain. I went back to work, and I was overwhelmingly welcomed back. Overwhelmingly welcomed back. There's always going to be a segment that wants to keep their feet on our neck, who wants to tell you that you're an alcoholic and you'll never be as good as you once were, because they know nothing about recovery or what we have to do to get sober. And they're entitled to that. No, but I didn't have any experiences like that, but I knew they were out there. Not many, I'm told. But at any rate, I went back, and the program and the promises just are just not limited. And as I approached my final year at Northwest, I got another phone call from the same pilot, no longer head of the pilot union. He said, "Guess what?" He said, "I just got notified by John Dasburg. He thinks you ought to be a 747 captain for your final year at Northwest." So I went back, I checked out, and that's the way I ended my career, in the left seat of a 747, entrusted to that airplane with all those people, all those crew members flying all over the world. This program, I could never have dreamt this. I couldn't even have hoped it. And I became good friends with that president of the airline. We had a number of meetings together, and I looked forward to them, and I enjoyed them. As I was retiring at the mandatory retirement age of 60 in 1998, my attorney contacted me. He says, "Guess what? Judge Rosenbaum has just told me that in 16 years on the federal bench, he has never supported a petition for pardon, but he wants to support yours if you want to try it." The toughest judge up there. I thought, what are the chances of getting a presidential pardon? One in a million? I thought, well, what are the chances I'd fly again? One in 50 million. So I put in the paperwork, and for 2 years, I did the work on that. And in 2001, January the 20th, I came in, and there were 8 messages telling me I just received a presidential pardon. That is a phenomenal life-altering event for a convicted felon. That changes life if you've got a felony conviction. I remember the second day in treatment, going to my first outside AA meeting, and I remember hearing the promises read for the first time. My head was down, but I started listening. I thought, why are they reading those promises? They're beautiful promises. There must be a reason they're reading them. And then they got to the part that says, no matter how far down the scale we've gone, we'll see our experience can benefit others. And I said, no, that won't apply to me. And I tuned it out. I just said, no, maybe for you guys, but not for me, because I'm headed way down. And I've had this incredible, amazing journey, much of which I haven't talked about tonight. I've talked for 69 minutes. I'm going to quit. That's longer than I normally talk. So I appreciate you having me here. Happy AA birthday. Thank you, Robert. Thank you, Joyce, for being here. Thanks all of you for my sobriety.